Good morning and welcome to a live burning platform. I know the last 2 weeks, the comment section has been angry. Yeah. People have been furious. They've been like, what's going on? Why are you being so lazy? Why haven't you done a show? Well, we did two events and we did a third one on Tuesday here at the podcast party. Actually talked about NHI and it was a furious debate, which you will be able to see if you go to YouTube. Make sure you like and subscribe and do all of the stuff that you have to. Podcast party, there it is. All right. And all the details will be posted in the comments and the description of the show below. So make sure that you're paying attention. Come on. You don't have time. I mean, this year has been insane. And if you're not paying attention, you're a dead man or woman. Speaking of men and women, we have one of each in the studio with us this morning, too. We've got the great Pumi Mashiko. Hello, Pumps.
Hello.
Yeah, the great. The extraordinary. And then I will get to that in a second, but we've got also the senior partner here at Podcast Party and host of his own show for many years from the original Cliff Central. Also a man who people, they wait on his every word. He is Timothy Maurice. No, they do. They do. Don't be coy about this now.
Did the words come from that frayed book?
What is that? Okay, so Pumi and Timothy were passing around this book, which looks so tattered and torn. What is it?
Called Bantu Philosophy.
Oh, yeah. Bantu Philosophy, yeah. Huh?
Bantu Philosophy.
All right, and why is it so frayed? Is it because there was only one copy, the old regime?
100-year-old books. I have all these, 100-year-old books from, stuff I collect over the years.
I like it. Well, perhaps we will have...
Are you bringing us Bantu Philosophy this morning?
Yeah. Listen, there is a link between this election and this stuff, and I have to make that link. Otherwise, we're just going to have, a conversation about wokeness.
Well, I'll tell you what, we do have a lot to unpack because it's only a week, only 1 week since America went to the polls and already the world feels like a completely different place, for better or worse. I mean, for some people, it's absolutely, definitely, positively worse. And for some people, it's absolutely, definitely, positively better. And we'll find out what the panel this morning. We're also going to be joined by the, as always, late Canthan Pillay, who doesn't seem to understand that Grayston Drive is usually busy this time of day.
He also doesn't understand the Bantu philosophy.
No.
You have to be there to wait for the train because trains don't
work. Right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was going to tell you a quick story, quick five seconds. So I was on this research trip in Japan with a group of Indians and Africans, black guys. The first thing they told us when we landed was they were worried about us. Yeah, now they were worried about it. There's a Japanese host who were like, I know you guys are from Africa and India. We have a trip to do. And she's like, my experience is that you guys are the worst in the world. And she was just blunt about it.
Oh my God. That's not great.
In Mumbai, the trains left on time, dude. The trains left on time. But also, the train left every 5 minutes or something. So if you missed one, there was another.
I might be greeting the situation. I'm just straight up. She's like, I deal with people all around the world, but you guys are the worst.
Well, when Pumi and I said that we were going to put a show together about the U.S. elections, we thought it was important to have an actual American here too. Now Timothy manages to stride the Atlantic Ocean like a colossus, so he has points of view that will be familiar to both us here in South Africa and to his fellow countrymen in the U.S. And I'm wondering how you're feeling because you voted. And how are you feeling with these results and all these things that have happened in like a week? It feels like the longest week ever for some.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about it. I'm sixth generation American. And I've been thinking about what that means to our family with land. You know, my cousin, so I got two sides of my family. One very strong Republican, one strong, another side is very strong Democrat. And they sent letters out to the broader family.
Wow.
Letters.
Yeah, my cousin Brianna.
Do y'all not have
BC.
Letters. Okay, wow. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Brianna, let me just pull this one up.
So there's a thing about the sound. We can see your comments, guys. Jack is working.
Oh.
We just don't, because we're all in the studio.
Here's Jack Mutlantis. Say good morning. There he is.
Yeah, so can they hear me, Jack? Is that?
Okay. They should now.
They can hear you, but
there we go.
We can hear you. Okay. We're in the
story. You repeat.
That's right.
Well, it's not switching over.
Won't let me choose this. Mm. Like that? No.
We have to exit you from the studio.
Yeah, I might have to start again here. Can you take over, or do we have to start the whole show again?
No, we can continue talking.
All right. I'm going to have to open this browser again, right?
You, because you guys asked me how things are going with my family. So this is the Democratic side of the family. She says, the quote opens with, "Everything is on fire, but everyone I love is doing beautiful things and trying to make life worth living. And I know I don't have to believe in everything, but I believe in that." And then I'm going to read two lines of the opening part of the letter. She says, "Dearest friends and family."
Is she the Republican?
No, the Democrat side. This is the Democrat side of the family.
She's in the health department. Of course, she's in the deep state.
Yeah, she's in the deep side. She says, "I know the last few days have been really rough and our emotions have been rightfully been all over the place. I just wanted you to know that I've been thinking of each of you." That's how it opens. I mean, and let me tell you, you know, she is, and it's funny because Kamala visited her husband's record shop in the campaign.
Oh, okay.
And so there was that kind of internal. Oh, you saw that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was huge for them. The record shop is just blown up now. Like, and they just kept reposting it and kept reposting it because it was part of their small business initiative. And so that record shop has just blown up. He's getting attention from all over the world and their whole life has basically changed. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit of bias there as well, but also, Brianna is also AKA, you know, Alpha Cal for Alpha, which is Kamala is also. And they also have, so just to show you how deep this letter is. It's a sorority. It's a female sorority that's pink and green. But also the last thing is my uncle who's a judge went to Howard as well. And as you know, Kamala went to Howard. And her sister, Brianna's sister, Camille, also went to Howard. So there's all of this extraordinary connection there. So that's where this letter is coming from.
Okay, but then they back the losing side.
Yeah.
Which is always terrible.
Yeah. Nobody likes a loser.
Nobody wants a loser. And we've got no time for this. So how are you feeling?
I mean, that was my first question.
Yeah, I mean, but I just saw this coming. And it was quite obvious to me.
When did you see it coming?
You know, I've been following this extremist woke dynamic. So I've got a client of mine in California named Raquel Brown, and she's been talking about how, for example, if something is less than $1,000 in a local shop, that people can just steal it and get away with it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she was just like, so I knew, and it's been obvious to me that the left had just gone too far. So I just saw it coming, and
it's been overridden now by Proposition
72 or something like that.
Kevin, welcome.
Yeah. A voice from the ether.
Yeah. So anyway, what's the surprise?
The state of California voted to make it once again to criminalize any shoplifting.
Because
what they had done was turn shoplifting into a misdemeanor rather than a felony.
So anyway, so I saw all of this coming. So it was just obvious that this was going to happen. So I am you know, I was already braced and kind of looking forward to some normalcy. I'm just glad the election wasn't close, because if it was close, it would have been chaos right now, right? So it's just kind of overwhelmingly obvious.
So let's just go over this for people who've been, I don't know, in a cave or under a rock or whatever. So this week, finally, the House returned all of its delegates, and we finally know what the numbers are. But the House is Republican with a slim majority. The Senate is Republican with a slim majority. White House is now Republican. The popular vote went to Donald Trump. And there are a number of other people down the ballot who, I think, point out exactly what Timothy's talking about here, that America kind of is correcting for what was an overcorrection to an overcorrection. And you can go back as long as you want in this game and say, well, you know, this administration did too much of that, so then this administration came in. But really, I think that things are moving so fast at the moment that talking about the election almost feels like history.
Yeah.
You know, we've got appointments this week already, and I think we can get into some of these. From, you know, Secretary of Defense, Director of National Intelligence, the Department of Government Efficiency, which is going to be very, very interesting to watch.
And is there any other country in the world who has a Department of Government Efficiency?
They all should.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, wouldn't it be great if they set a trend here? And
incredible, right?
If our government goes, well, you know, we could
like a
do
bit
that.
Of an oxymoron to me.
Save,
but...
I know. Look, government efficiency. But look what the people in question, two very capable people from the private sector who we know have the ability to change enormous designs on humanity, right? I mean, like Vivek and Elon, these are not like small pishers from some local bank, you know, who've been in middle management for a long time and then eventually became CEOs. These are guys who are visionary and can make shit happen. And if they can't do it, then truly we will have to put this thing about government efficiency to bed forever.
Exactly. If they fail, guys. I mean, really.
And frankly, while you talk about failure, I think that the stakes are extremely high for Donald Trump too, because people are, this time around, I mean, you can already see the ratings in CNN and MSNBC have come in for this first couple of days of the Trump, the president-elect's next term, and they are toilet. I mean, CNN is laying off some of their biggest names. We don't know who yet, but they're going to. They're announcing these things already. So what we've got is high stakes for Trump. He's got all the pressure on him now. And in some way, I was talking to Jack about this earlier, it is a great relief to see him handing over important cabinet jobs to people in their 40s. We've had people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s running America for years. And Trump himself is a very old man, but he's handing on the baton to a new generation in a way that Kamala campaigned as the new generation. But we're seeing something completely different. Do you agree?
Yeah,
absolutely. But I think the crucial point that you raised there, Gareth, with regard to the mainstream media, this is the death of the mainstream media. It's never going to come back.
The biggest loser in this election, right?
And they only have themselves to blame.
Mm-hmm. No, they've covered themselves in stupidity and credulousness. And they thought that the people of the United States were as stupid as they were, and the people all over the world.
So I think that there are a couple of different things that this election has highlighted for all of us watching it, right? And I suppose some of the people that were participating in it. And I want us to not get like, because there's so many parts of it, we're going to get like thrown all over the place. I do want us to talk first, and it is history, Gareth. I actually think it is history, and it is worth spending a moment to unpack some of these things. I want us to talk about the campaign itself first, because I think we watched, before we talk about the media and the role and what it looks like going forward, I really do want us to spend a little bit of time, sure, which is what I wanted to ask you, why I asked you when you saw it coming.
Yeah.
Because I think for a long time, we watched a campaign play out in a vastly different way from what we have seen in the past, right? It's been a long time since we've seen on the Democratic side a handing over of the baton from the current to a vice president,
yeah,
which is what happened with Kamala and Joe Biden. But it was slightly different from what people are used to seeing because there were no primaries. Do you think, watching it as you were watching it, that hurt Kamala?
I do. And I also think that I think Kamala is emblematic of a larger movement that's going to happen regardless post-Trump. I'm going to be very clear about this. The Trump moment is basically just slowing down a bigger train that's coming. And I know this is very controversial.
What does that mean?
I know this is very controversial, but we're going to get into this a bit. But the Republicans understand this. This is why they spent in Rands, 2.5 billion Rands to paint her as the trans leader. They literally spent $145 million to paint her as an extremist left wokist. That was a line item. And because they understand that this train is coming and she has to be the face of the train. And on some level, she is the face of that train, but that is, she's an exaggerated moment in that train. They need to be a slightly more balanced person to kind of lead some of this extremism, because this extremism has some roots in some legitimacy, but they have exacerbated it to a point where it's just too much for anybody to take, which is why the Trump phenomenon is just kind of, you know, there to kind of stymie this a bit. I don't think there's anybody, I don't care how intelligent you are, who doesn't understand that some of the wokeness has roots in legitimacy, but they have just simply gone too far. There are items in the woke agenda that need to be addressed, but they basically just simply went too far. And she was the face of going too far.
Well, I mean, you talk about spending, but the Democrats spent themselves into a hole, and she owes $200 million.
And Trump has offered to pay the bills.
Yeah, and Trump's got a surplus left after spending all this money trying to, to paraphrase you, demonize her. But the fact is, she was a shit candidate. She was she was unimpressive in every way. And she exemplified so much of what people are sick of in terms of not just wokeism, but also this idea that if you just tick boxes, which is what the Democrats have become obsessed with, you know, if you're a trans lesbian in a wheelchair, then you get the job ahead of everyone else. This was an unimpressive.
But that's not what she is.
No, she's a middle of the road. They thought that being a woman of color would be enough to get her across the line with most Democrats. The key demographics here that they were hoping for did not vote for her in the numbers that they hoped they would.
I think, though,
right?
What you are exemplifying, Gareth, is exactly what Timothy is saying, that they spent all of this money.
They did an incredible job.
To believe that she is this, like,
that she's a bumbling idiot as well.
This trans movement, whatever.
Because she can't be both.
Hold on.
She can't be both.
And can't be both of what? Let's frame it.
So is she, because remember what they did with Trump in the last election, and it was clever of the Democrats to do this. They said he's a dangerous Hitlerian villain who has plans to turn America into the Fourth Reich, right? Or he's an old bumbling idiot who it talks about grabbing pussy and stuff like that. So it can't be both. You either are an absolutely evil villain who has a plan to destroy things, or you're a moron. And I think she was parachuted in when Biden clearly couldn't maintain any semblance of his own dignity in front of a microphone and camera, and still can't. I mean, he looks like he's either on meds or wishes he was at the beach with some pudding. But the fact is, this woman has come in, and the Democrats proffered her as like the joy candidate. This amazing, you know, this is the future. We're giving you a vision of hope. But at the same time, she was saying, America's a terrible place and we've been running it really badly. Not me, but Biden, even though I was part of the administration. So what is she? We didn't really know. And most people who actually wanted to get to know her, they say, oh, well, she only had 170 days. Most people who wanted to get to know her saw her reading the same speech out at every rally, saw her making very controlled media interview. I want to almost say that she was condescending to do certain interviews and she wouldn't do others. Whereas the other side were talking to anyone and everyone that would ask them to come. And I think that that's a mistake. So I'm asking, who was she
Because everybody has this idea that she was too woke or she was this.
Well, the truth is no one knew what she was because there was no point at which she actually said what she stood for. So everyone asked her, for example, what is it about the Biden administration that she had a problem with? She said, no, Biden did a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. Then asked, what are you going to do differently? She was not able to actually quantify that mm-hmm. either. At the point at which she gets asked very specific questions like, are you going to deport the migrants and send them back? And her response was, I will obey the law.
Yeah, it's the same response she gave when she was asked about giving people in prison transgender operations.
And I mean, again, it
these
was
are things you, if I'll she obey just the said, law. If she just said, don't be ridiculous, that's a stupid idea. That's not a priority of my administration. But she couldn't. She bumbled and fumbled her way through every answer to every question. And can I tell you, I thought her concession speech was the best speech she's given. She looked relieved. I'm sure that all her handlers have been driving her up the wall. This poor woman just wants to go back to California and live a normal life. She probably will disappear completely. That's my prediction, because it's not like anyone's going to be knocking on her door anytime soon. She's not good at anything. But she was palpably relieved. You could see she was like natural. She was relaxed. She was like, thank God this is over without saying it.
She's not going to disappear.
I hope she does.
You don't think so?
No. She got 72 million votes. There's not been anything close to that amount of votes. Let me just be clear about something. If you were to pit and do an IQ test with Kamala and Trump, who do you think would have the highest IQ?
I tell you, she's got a very low IQ.
What do you guys think? What do you think, Ken?
I don't think it's about IQ.
But that's the question I'm asking.
I think that Kamala. Trump would win hands down.
Okay. I think Trump would win.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So there's zero evidence in their background to support that.
There's zero evidence of her ever having achieved a thing. What has she done?
So
like name a thing. Just so, one thing.
Let me this is gonna be really fun, by the way. Guys,
no, but Timothy, anybody who's interested,
let him finish.
No, I want to take your point. Okay. You say that she's definitely not done. Could you walk us through where she's going to go from here?
Because I think that's a more interesting train of thought.
Yeah, Kantha, I really appreciate you wanting to have an agenda relative to my conversation, but that's not going to happen. I'm too seasoned for this.
All right.
So let me be very clear about something. That when you look at her law school records, when you look at her background, when you look at both of their background prior to even stepping into politics, they both have, on some level, impressive backgrounds prior to politics. Politics is messaging. Politics is symbolism. Politics is propping up puppets. You know, it's interesting because I'm happy I'm on this conversation because my family is also third generation Secret Service. I know a lot that's going on behind the scenes. The messaging handlers are critically important to this conversation. And the idea that, for example, that Bush created this kind of folksy accent to convince you that he was a part of a certain demographic of America.
Nuclear.
Is extremely important to this conversation. They engineer perspective. And it's possible that we're thinking of this conversation far too low. And if you're going to fall into that trap, what I call the algorithmic narrative trap of she's just painted as goofy, he's painted as powerful, then we're not having the best conversation. And I know that the minds in this room can have a better conversation than this.
Timothy, can I just say, one of the things that, for me, watching her campaign was quite disconcerting, besides the fact that she wasn't taking outside of the media that she liked, that she wanted.
Yeah, she did towards the end, but in the beginning.
I was interested to see, as a communication strategist person, and one of the people I absolutely admire in terms of political strategy is David Axelrod, who calls the electioneering process the hardest job interview the world. It actually showed that maybe she is not ready for this job because she wasn't test driven, as it were. She didn't go through the paces. Mm. So maybe she didn't want it hard enough. But I also remember, I think a year after the last election, Donald Trump playing golf and them saying, how does it feel? You were number 45. How does it feel? And he said number 45 and number 47.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Did you see that?
Yeah.
And even then, myself, oh my God, this guy, he, a year after losing the way that he had, and he hit that ball afterwards with such strong confidence. I was like, he's going to do this. He's going to come back and he's going to fight hard for this thing. And he fought for it.
Yeah. Let me follow up with this. Trump was perfect. It's perfect to play the power game, which is what a politician needs to do in the States. He is well poised. He may have a lot of weaknesses, but he understands the symbolism of power like very few people. When you look at the MAGA messaging, he got every single thing about messaging right. See, I studied the science of this stuff. And what he did was convince everybody in this kind of algorithm moment that his messaging, what we call it, the availability bias, that when you went to vote at the end of the day, the first thing that pops up in your mind, and it becomes this extraordinary unconscious bias that he's going to make it great again. You don't have any messaging. Her team fumbled this so bad. There is no messaging for her to hold on to. So that's why she's fumbling. That's why she's fumbling.
She had three texts. She had three texts.
She's literally all over the place. So my point is, the system that he put together, he obviously had experience in this, and the Republicans are just much more clear and pragmatic about their messaging and their systemic approach to propping up his clear messaging. And he led a part of it. I saw one documentary where he was driving the tweets behind the scenes, right?
Mm.
And she is just what felt to me like this lost person in a lost campaign. I would like to see her with the machine that he had and see what happens.
I hope you're right, because then the Republicans will be in charge in America for another decade.
Let's talk about the machine of the Republicans.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the machine of the Republicans, because it was also fascinating to watch this time around. And 4 years ago, when we had the conversation after he lost and after January 6th, my view was that Trump had broken the Republic, the GOP, into his image.
Mm.
Right. So he had broken that party into his image.
Yeah.
And to see in this last election, so many seasoned, senior Republican politicians and representatives actually saying, we are not endorsing Trump. We are not behind Trump. I think even internally within the GOP, there's some kind of, they were hoping that Trump wouldn't win so they could win back. So the moderate part of the Republican Party could win back control.
Yeah.
And now they too have lost. What do you think is happening on the other side of that Republican curtain? And Quo Vadis, where to?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Trump is a unique force in history. We'll be looking back, you know, 50 years from now, those who are living. I mean, he's an outlier in every sense. There is no one else like this man. Like the levels, I mean, you got to understand that
the energy, the guy was up to 72
hours. He's a different beast. He's a different beast.
To the eve of the election, absolutely.
He's a different beast. He's just wired different historically. His family has been exposed him as a kid to levels of power and navigating power. He understands this. You can imagine the adrenaline is pumping because he's 10 steps ahead of everybody else.
Hmm. Okay.
So to the point that you were making, which I actually agree with in terms of the way in which you engage with people and the way in which you speak to them and the way in which you relate to them, that used to be the case for the longest time. My point right now is that what actually tipped the balance in this election that was entirely different was the fact that we had these long-form conversations that took place on a number of podcasts.
And we can see from the numbers
where Trump was able to speak from the heart. So it's very different to the type of scenario where Kamala
is... It's performative, it's scripted.
Yes, yeah. So Kamala is in a particular environment. She adjusts her accent accordingly. We all do that as human beings. I mean, when I'm in the U.S., I always adjust my accent because otherwise I'm not able to communicate with them.
But enough about Musimamane.
But enough about Musimamane, exactly. But for the first time, there were these long-form conversations where people were able to actually see what people were like when they're speaking off the cuff without a scripted teleprompter. And that then informs them. I get what this guy is saying, and everything that I've heard about him so far is wrong.
And this is where Trump is amazing, because he is also a marketing machine.
But why are you guys so sure about this?
Okay, so I'll tell where you, are you I'll getting tell this certainty because, from? Because we've had 4 years in the world of just being lied to by an administration that told us that the man in charge with the nuclear codes was totally cogent and sane and with it. And we know from watching him and observing him, they were saying, never mind what your own eyes are telling you, but look over here while we tell you everything's fine. You know, I mean, the White House has been telling us for months that there's nothing wrong with Joe Biden. He's perfectly okay, and he's a great president. Then they tell us suddenly that they're going to replace him with Kamala in the Democrat election for president, and they throw him out unceremoniously, but they keep him as president. Because they think they can keep the play going. It's all a performance. It's like, and we've had enough. Tony Blair and Bill Clinton started this performative politics thing where you play the role of a president, but, you know, there are other people. There are officiaries who are going to do the actual work. You just have to smile and glad hand and wave and pose for the photographs and all of that crap. And I think Canton's right in that people wanted, they don't just want someone who can answer questions or talk without a script. They wanted someone whose brain works and who can adapt to situations as they occur.
And Obama was brilliant at that.
Obama was superb at it. Ooh. In fact, he was the apotheosis of performative politics with competence, okay? Especially in his first term. He did all the right things. I'm going to be a president for not the red states, not the blue states, the United States. You know, and he had his messaging was on point, but he also delivered on all the things that he promised. Then we had years of just complete bullshit where people were performing, and it's enough. They're sick of it, and they saw Kamala, and they saw through her.
Let's break down they. Let's break down they, though. We're talking about two states that fundamentally changed this election. Are you telling people in North Carolina and Pennsylvania were listening to Joe Rogan?
No, wait.
This is my point. There seems to be a lot of certainty here about what actually happened. Let me tell you what my family is saying. Let me tell you about what my friends on the ground in both Pennsylvania, my former colleagues who are in the middle of Pennsylvania working for the former US Airways that are struggling now. I worked for US Airways when I was in college. Let me tell you what my cousins on the ground are actually saying, both Democratic and Republican. Can we do that?
Mm-hmm. Instead of making a bit sure.
Yeah, but let's make it super clear that these anecdotal stories represent voters, not people sitting in South Africa with, you know, a view from Twitter.
But they're all off the laptop class, basically.
Well, here's what I know. That, you know, my instincts around, you know, versus my conversations with people often collide. So let's talk about, for example, the guy in Pennsylvania who's just simply looking at the fact that eggs cost a particular price and he want them down. He wants the prices to come down. Or in North Carolina, they're looking at gas prices, et cetera, et cetera. The gap between what we think happened and what might have happened is a real gap. Mm-hmm. And I think, one of my favorite quotes is hold certainty lightly. Part of the challenge with this conversation for me is that I don't think we are aware of just how sophisticated the machine is to kind of engineer perspective, to kind of engineer a voting pattern from social media. Why are you guys not saying that Elon Musk's ability to kind of engineer a shift in these algorithms are
because
bigger
reason?
Because
of the fact that Google kept him off the search lists for 2 years, that YouTube absolutely shut down his channel for 2 years while he was running for president, that Facebook admitted that they had deliberately manipulated figures. I will tell you three measurable points that are not related to Joe Rogan. First point was when he got shot. And when he stood with fist in air, I said, this guy has nailed it.
Courage.
The second point was they're eating the cats. They're eating the dogs. And there was again that immediate bump in the numbers.
And a meme.
Yes. And the third point was Peanut.
The squirrel.
Peanut the squirrel. And immediately at that point, no one wants the state coming into their house to shoot their pet. And that was a Democratic state. fundamentally that. So it's not all about Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan was pivotal purely based on
that. That was my point.
You're right. He would not tip, he would not tip 50 million votes, even though he gets something like 50 million views. But the fact that 50 million people sit and listen through a
But we're talking about swing states. Mm. Let's narrow the conversation. We're talking about the states that decided the election.
But then what about the popular vote? Because that's not just something that you can dismiss at a glance. Because I
First
heard,
Republican but you, to win the popular vote.
You agree with what he
said. Exactly. This is my whole point.
I listen to people on the left, too. I listen to Bill Maher. There are a couple of people who I really think are smart. He was saying, oh, no, Kamala's got this a couple of weeks ago. And I thought, I didn't know. I didn't know until, you know, well into the process who was going to win. So there wasn't the certainty that Timothy refers to. Not from me. And I think it's good. It's
when
good
you
that
didn't
you don't...
arrive at the Catholics' dinner. I was a little bit like,
Yeah, but she would it would have been an absolute disaster for her. She's not a, she doesn't have, you know, where Timothy's right is that Trump has been in front of cameras his whole life. The guy's had an apprenticeship when it comes to messaging and dealing with the media and marketing. He's the greatest marketer in the world. The greatest
and
marketer.
And I don't even think there's anybody close.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But let's just move on from this. What do you think it means for South Africa? Because I'm meeting a bunch of people who are very sore about the Democrats' loss, saying, oh, this is terrible. It's going to mean the end of a AGOA. It's going to mean a change in our relationship, all kinds of other stuff, which is just not true. Everybody immediately signaled that the rand had dropped against the dollar when Trump won. It seems to have kind of stabilized since then. What do you think?
The dollar surged.
The dollar surged. Thank
the
you.
Dollar surged.
Yeah,
the
right.
dollar
surged. Yes, but yeah. You know what
the
I mean.
Like, didn't drop.
I had friends who support Democrats and who love what's going on in America more than they love South African politics. And they were all saying to me, oh, you see, the drop in the rand. You're right. It's the rise of the dollar, rather. And I do think that
were
indicates...
Were you happy with your Bitcoin?
Yeah, I was. I was very happy. But the point is also that I think this administration is going to be more business friendly than probably any other administration in history.
And let's talk practically on how that will play out. So one of the most successful Africa trade investment initiatives ever was initiated by Trump in his first term. What's Prosper Africa is extraordinarily successful. So I represent, I consult some U.S. interest. So Trump's executive orders, we follow very closely. One of the Biden and Harris executive orders that was quite popular for Democrats when they first took office was Executive Order 13985, which said that a certain percentage of minorities had to get certain contracts. It was very controversial, but it was very popular because they spent a lot of money helping open up doors for women-owned business, et cetera, et cetera. So these executive orders are really important. Trump's philosophy around Africa is just very practical. Hmm. He's like, it needs to succeed. It needs to.
That's executive order shithole country that you're referring to.
But Prosper Africa is one of his initiatives. I suspect he's going to ramp up opportunities. I mean, the amount of investment they've spent, you're talking about $120 billion in economic value for both Africa and America through Prosper Africa. $1 billion. So I suspect his desire to compete with China for African resources is going to create more opportunity for Africa to get involved. And remember, these trade and investment deals that happen are massive because the U.S. market is massive. So we're seeing entrepreneurs export to the States that wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to export because of some of his policies. So AGOA and some of those may, some of those legacy type of trade agreements may fall to the side for more pragmatic opportunities.
So you mentioned his desire to outperform China, and this for South Africans is what one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, because another thing that Trump understands is that you need an enemy, and China is squarely in his sights. And South Africa sits in a place where our relationship with China has all sorts of ramifications for us. And I'm wondering how you think Trump is going to respond to South Africa's very specific foreign policy around China, around Russia, and how and the posture that we've taken over the past couple of years. And as everybody likes to say in the ANC, BRICS,
And we must point out that China is our biggest trading partner currently.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge challenge. I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about that dynamic. What I will say is that it feels as though we're almost fighting a losing battle at this stage. I mean, China's muscle is insane. I mean, I had a friend of mine, he's in VC, venture capital, and he's like, you know, when they show up in Rwanda to do a deal, they get laughed at the amount of dollars they have compared to what China is bringing to the table. Like, it's insane. Like, they just throwing insane amounts of dollars. You can't even compete with them on some levels. I looked recently at the what's happening in Zambia. You know, Zambia is currently in debt to China to more than $10 million, $10 billion. And China is now poised to take over Zambia's national power and utility company because of it. They are highly sophisticated.
And the way that, you know, a friend of mine who is in, I suppose, diplomatic circles, talks about how when China comes into a room to negotiate, they leave nothing on the table. Mm. You know, you're talking about the executive orders and kind of Africa Prosper and AGOA and those kinds of things, which do have a give and take, right? Which leaves something for the Africans as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it'll be fascinating. I think it's one of the things that I'm interested in seeing.
If the administration of US was not sending billions and billions to forever wars, they would have money to put on the table in terms of trade. And that's the critical difference in terms of Trump versus a Biden/Harris administration. They're actually going to move money away from doing the forever wars. So no money for Ukraine. That's money that gets poured back into doing things like actually providing housing for veterans, as an example. But Trump is going to be very big on that type of thing. The single biggest benefit for us, though, in this country that I'll see coming immediately is that Trump is going to drive down the price of fuel drastically because of this drill, baby, drill thing. Now, there's a very good strategic reason why he needs to do that, because he recognizes that artificially inflating the price of oil, which is what the Biden administration did immediately at the point at which they killed the Keystone pipeline, was a huge boost to Russia, because that artificially inflated the price of oil, boosted Russia's economy to the point that it was able to overtake the UK and displace it. And it's now sitting at the fourth biggest economy in the world after India and China.
And already Europe is saying, hey, we might be more interested in buying US oil and gas.
Absolutely. Right? But when the price of oil comes down,
that defunds Russia.
Yes. But when the price of oil comes down, that's the single biggest thing that holds us back in this country right now, because all of the inflationary stuff we've seen in this country has been directly related to fuel costs. Because we need, just to run this country, we need something like 540,000 barrels of oil per day. Now, you translate that into dollar terms, which is money that flows out of the country on a daily basis. And if that price gets reduced by 30%, that's an immediate boost to the bottom line of the country. So that's the biggest benefit that I see coming out of this. Even if the trade deals with Trump, with the Trump administration, don't change in the slightest.
Yeah. I'm very interested. So I'm looking at the time, and I see we still haven't spoken about your Bantu philosophy. I'll be very
about the one philosophy.
If we walk,
this book.
This is your moment. This is your moment to shine, Timothy, with your Bantu philosophy.
So why are you interested? I just brought this book in because I'm rereading it. It's basically a book on a former missionary, Mr. Reverend Placid Temples, basically wrote an apology for the missionaries' undermining of basically African cultures. And one of the biggest principle that came out of this, which I think is linked to wokeness, and which is why I think this train is coming no matter what, is that he believed that they created a philosophy called deracination. Mm-hmm. And deracination is essentially because they came in, the missionaries came into Africa so pompous that they didn't even respect any African principles whatsoever. They undermined them and they engineered a belief amongst missionaries that there was no inherent value in the, you know, the locals' cultures and philosophies.
Which church was this, Timothy? Sorry.
So,
must have been the Methodists. Yeah. Sounds like the Methodists.
So, well, let me just say that. So this book is interesting for me because he had a scientific kind of underpinning. And the idea was, it wasn't so much he came back as some sort of liberal apologist. It was more he came back from a scientific lens to go, let's look at these cultural principles. Let's look at the artifacts. Let's look deep and see where we went wrong and what we could potentially do. And what he, this deracination on page 2 opens up, deracination, those who have been torn away from their ethnic roots. It's essentially what colonialism did, was to rip people away and go, okay, you can still practice this stuff on the side, but when you get integrated in society, you got to take on the Western ideology, and we're going to force it. So what you do, what you create is a split human being that has two value systems trying to make a single decision. And with that sort of weaker view in his positioning, what you get is sometime a torn person. And so his whole entire point, and why I've been interested in this and this kind of Trump-Harris moment, is I think wokeness comes from this idea of people feel ripped apart in their value system. And sometimes when you don't have a scientific basis for why you feel a particular way, you end up wildly fighting for what you want without any sort of raw kind of basis. And so this kind of movement, this kind of woke movement is extreme at the moment, but I feel like it's going to become more refined as the science evolves. And for me, it's going to be really interesting to see probably in the next 15 years what happens.
I think what's going to happen in the next 15 years is that the guts is going to be ripped out from the American educational system.
Yeah, good.
So that all of the woke indoctrination that has been taken place for the longest time is going to stop. But more to the point, we will get to the point in as little as 5 years' time that universities will no longer matter. And the reason why universities will no longer matter is because you will have individual guided instruction that is driven by AI that will pace learning to exactly the individual. Mm-hmm. And more to the point, it'll be free. You will no longer be paying $100,000 a year, which is what you pay now to go to an Ivy League university. And you're going to end up with skills that are actually going to be able to... Sorry, go for it, Gareth.
This is the point where Canton tells us about which Ivy League university he went to. And he mentions that he's an alumnus, and he gives them an honorarium. And go on.
Through his rotary.
No, I'm saying that Ivy League university is toast as well, mm-hmm. as are all of them, because the guts are going to be ripped out from them. They're not going to be getting those federal subsidies. And this is a 20-year project on the part of Team Trump. And more to the point, he's got the intellectual capital and the financial capital to actually execute this plan to turn the United States back into a meritocracy, which is what made the country great to start off with. And that path is never going to come back. And the point around all of the wokeism, another critical thing I must point out that became very significant in this election, and I'll use myself as a case in point. I've always supported gay rights. I've always supported gay marriage. And Trump was the only person who, before running for president, said that he supported gay marriage. Even Obama did not do that. Obama supported through the back door. What happened was that the entire gay rights movement got weaponized by the trans lobby. And the trans lobby never had anything to do with gay rights. Gay rights was always about the rights of individuals.
And
the trans lobby was all about castrating the society.
Yeah.
And
I think Canton brings up something. So the worst position in this election was the trans. That was a poison chalice, this trans lobby that has
been. But it's castration of children. What it is.
But the fact is that this probably, out of all the things, the border, the economy, all of that stuff, because it's such an obvious thing to people that you shouldn't be giving puberty blockers and surgeries to kids under the age of 15, I think everybody went, whoa. Even Kamala wouldn't associate with it directly, right? She was like, I will follow the law.
But nobody was listening, because what you need is a clear position on these things. And I'm afraid it has been repudiated. For those who think that this is a, you know, some kind of a stall on the trans train, it's not. It's repudiated completely by the American public. You can tell that there was absolutely zero support for this. It didn't come up if the Democrats had any choice in bringing it up. And it came up in that Trump ad, which was brilliant, where he said, he's for you, she's for they, them. Yeah. Never forget. I mean, that's great. That's great marketing.
Let's great also not messaging, forget but you that know, it was personal for Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Very personal. Yeah.
What I want to talk about, and there was a question in the comment section as well, is the role of Elon Musk in this election and his buying Twitter and then completely working it into the machinery of Donald Trump. And also, watching over the past couple of days as Donald Trump has been appointing all of the various people, there's a collective meltdown on the side of Twitter, of the Twitter activists, around what they seem to believe is a Donald Trump absolutely betraying the people who supported him to the end, particularly deep MAGA people. Do you think, without Elon Musk and Twitter's intervention, that Trump could have won the popular vote in the way that he did?
I don't know about the popular vote, but I think the electoral vote he would have won anyway. I think what Elon Musk has done really well is kind of help accelerate everything Trump is trying to do. And did it in a masterful way. You know, I look forward to
seeing. Gray says in the comments, apologies, Timothy, but this is good. Trust a South African to fix America.
Yeah.
We'll take it.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, do you think MIT is going to be done in 5 years? Are you being serious?
So, let's just separate the practical stuff from the academics.
I will say, for all intents and purposes, MIT is largely done in 5 years' time. And I'll tell you why. Because nearly all of the advances that are currently emerging are coming from the private sector. Mm. So if you look, for example, in all of the advances that have been made in large language models, they're not even teaching the stuff yet at the universities because they can't keep up with it. They don't have access to the resources. They don't have access to be able to means test any of the theories that they come up with. All of this is coming out from the private sector. Look at exactly the same advances in terms of development of pharmaceuticals, in terms of lithium battery technology. If you look in terms of all of the space technology, all of that stuff is not being taught in the textbooks. Just in terms of computer science in of itself, you're already at the stage where machine learning is able to effectively code at a PhD level, which means that you're spending 4 years of getting a computer science degree, which is pretty much obsolete. So the role of places like MIT, really, they're going to have to completely revisit what they're doing because it's out of the window in terms of.
So you think people are just going to be home learning in their living room? They need no sort of community to learn and so forth.
The entire dynamics of the world is going to change drastically. And I'll say this much in terms of community to learn. Learning is a lonely process. It's an individual process. Yes, you socialize at university. Yes, you have fun at the sororities. But at the end of the day, when you are sitting down with that exam paper, it is you and your brain, and there's no one else in that room with you.
You know my biggest takeaway from spending 2 years at MIT?
Say that again.
You know my biggest takeaway from spending 2 years at MIT were my friends that I met from Saudi Arabia. My friends I met in Saudi who have kind of helped me rethink, you know, the women's empowerment movement in Saudi. One of them is a neuroscientist that's in residency now back at MIT. It's those relationships. Here's my thing. Here's what I'm trying to guard against in this whole conversation. So I think we need to be cutting people.
It's not worth $100,000 a year to get those relationships.
Yeah, simply. I don't.
You can get them on Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can connect you can get them on Twitter. You want. I just want to read this before you make your point. Elizabeth Warren tweets out, "The Office of Government Efficiency is off to a great start with two leaders, two people to do the work of one person. yeah, this seems really efficient. So Elon replies, which I love. I mean, this is why Twitter connects everybody, right? All see everybody's conversations. This is true free speech happening in front of our very eyes. Elon goes, unlike you, neither of us are being paid. So it's very efficient indeed. Doge will do great things for the American people. Let history be the judge. And then someone comments under that, you're just angry because Vivek actually is Indian and you pretended to be. So, you know, you can't just get away with being in the corridors of power and being a senator and everyone must respect you. That automatic authority is gone. So,
yeah. No, I was just going to say that I think we're in a highly disruptive space. And I think Canton is definitely onto something. I believe, you know, Jordan Peterson's new model of education. I believe all of this stuff is going to change. And I also believe the wokeness, probably only like 10% of it. All this kind of cutting people and trans stuff is really exaggerated relative to, you know, what's happening. But I think the extraordinary disruptive nature, I don't think we have a full grasp. And I think we need to guard against thinking we think we know what's going to happen. I think there's going to be massive shift over the next 5-10 years towards an evolved thing that we haven't seen yet.
I think you're right.
But it's going to be out of state control. And that is the most crucial thing.
I think that's a very welcome thing indeed. And of course, there will still be powerful states in the world, chief among them, China. I don't see Vladimir Putin letting go of the controls of Russia anytime soon. But certainly the next 4 years will be disruptive. And I just want to point out that there are so many people, we can't predict the future. None of us in this room, nobody could have predicted this election. I guarantee you there were people inside of Trump's camp and even Elon who were not sure until the results came through. Because there's a lot of room
even
to
Trump
get things wrong.
A little surprised.
But it must be so awful to be getting things wrong all the time, like our friends at News 24 and the Daily Maverick. I mean, these are the most useless. Let me just point out, these are the most useless people. So I predicted that Javier Milei would make Argentina great again, and it appears they now finally are working their way towards a budget surplus. Their inflation rate has come right down to 2.4% from being in the hundreds. There are practical ways that are tried and tested that have to do with human behavior, you know about this, Timothy, and the way that people trade with each other, that are now established truths, and there are people who will try and try again to bring back old and discredited systems. We're seeing this happen in America again. And I think that this in some way is like testament to the fact that, sure, there are lots of new ideas and we should be open to those ideas. But things that are patently wrong, we should also be able to call out as patently wrong. It's enough experimentation in certain fields.
I agree with
right?
that.
And that's where academia has let themselves down too. So I want to point out that there are so many people in the media establishment, to go back to Canton's original point, who have utterly discredited themselves. They are a disgrace to the microphones and cameras that they speak to, because their audience is diminishing by the day, and rightly so. And they have done this to themselves. No one has engineered their destruction. They've done all of this themselves, and they know how, and they know when it happened, and they know why it happened. So I hope they will pipe the fuck down.
DSTV has lost 800,000 subscribers. Just quantify that in terms of how many hundreds of rands per month? 800,000 subscribers that they've
lost. Let's do the math real quick. The average was 500 a month.
Yeah. But guys,
why
you know
are you busy doing that math? I think one of the things that every election, I cannot believe how resilient this particular industry sector is, considering they get things wrong all the time. Are the fucking polls.
Yeah, the polls like,
they're polling all the time. And after every election, I'm like,
how many times have we said on this platform, the only poll that matters is the actual election?
And the betting market.
Yeah.
But they were all playing the 50-50 game right to the end, right?
I want to make a case to you in terms of the future of the U.S. Okay, so what I would like to see is I would like to see a resurgence of the Democratic Party. Okay, there were candidates that put themselves forward over the past election, like Dean Phillips, like Marianne Williamson, who I really liked. I liked the things that they were saying.
Bernie had some good ideas.
Bernie had good ideas, But let's work on the assumption that Bernie's passed his sell-by date.
Yeah,
the point at which Trump was able to turn around the Republican Party was when he was able to topple the leadership of the Republican National Convention. The same thing, to my mind, needs to happen with the Democrats. You actually need it to become a democratic institution once again. You need open primaries where good people are able to step up. What was really crucial for me was the fact that in terms of split votes, AOC retained her seat.
Yep.
But meanwhile, that same constituency voted overwhelmingly for Trump. Why did they vote for her? Because, and she invited comments on Twitter to say, why did you split your vote? And they say, well, we trust you. We don't trust those guys. And I think it's crucial. The lesson that has been learned is that the Democrats need to do that. They need to get back to having open primaries, to be having a clear path to a meritocracy in terms of the leadership of that party. And I think at that point, they are going to reclaim both the moral high ground and the electoral high
ground. And they've got to pivot away from the left and into the moderate realm. Because if you go into the center, you win. Bill Clinton knew this. Barack Obama knew this. That's how you win. This ever greater magnetic pull that the Democrats feel to their left and most woke has hurt them.
Yeah. There's zero. I mean, the idea that people start questioning the merits of science is when everything just fell apart. Like, if your woke agenda is not based on merit and science, it's a dead end. The end of the day, at my core is the belief in the scientific method that if your ideals around anything around wokeness is not based in something besides emotion.
You had Admiral Rachel Levine as the head of human health science. I mean, it's
disaster.
Just a mockery.
A mockery.
Yeah. Every person with eyes looks at this and goes,
yeah,
you can't bullshit me my face.
Yeah. So I do hope, Canton, I mean, it's a very powerful point that you're sort of closing with, because at the end of the day, I think somewhere along the line, which is why I've been reading this book again, the wild sort of emotion coming from the extreme left is this kind of frustrated feeling that I'm experiencing something I can't fully articulate, so I'm just going to scream wildly.
And they do.
Yeah, until somebody hears me. And I have enough sort of empathy. I can hold my empathetic side and my scientific side very well. And I can kind of feel this extremism that I can't fully understand what the fuck I'm dealing with. But I know that this other extreme right is inflaming what I'm feeling. And I just don't get it, but I'm going to fight for it. Somewhere along the line, I think the Democrats need a sophisticated, scientific-based leader to kind of pull them back, as like Gareth said, to this sort of middle point. Because you don't change several hundred years of bad science overnight. And that's what they're trying to do.
Well, just to end that thought, from my point of view, the greatest mistake I think that the Democrats have made in my lifetime, was their positioning during COVID. And I know that that was also the response of many Republicans to an emergency, to a pandemic, which turned out not to be what they'd told us it was. And, you know, these drugs will sort you out and you can't be contagious. And all these lies that were anti-science, but we were told by the scientific community, who'd basically shut down any opposition before Elon bought Twitter, to say, just believe me. And I don't think people believe. If I'm going to tie anything together from this conversation, it's that people are going back to first principles on everything. They're going, I'm not just going to believe you because you're a senator or because you got a PhD or because you're at a university or because you're in the media. I don't believe you anymore. You have to prove to me that you deserve my trust. And if you can do that, I'll vote for you. I'll put you in a position where you can clean out the government. I'll make sure that you have my support. I'll go to your rallies. I'll do whatever I have to do. People are desperate for leadership, but they're sick of being lied to.
It's brilliant. There's nothing to say after that.
Okay, that's it.
That's it? Is that all? Nothing else? People are saying an hour is not enough for this discussion. Only poor people have enemies, says Azalea. Yeah, I don't understand that either, but don't worry. Azalea's obviously hit the bottle early this morning.
Yeah,
yeah, but he's not too much of a leader or logical man. Tom Cruise is an option. No scandals, technically. Are you, Xavier, do you know who the Scientology, the Church of Scientology is? Are you insane?
I think it's time to shut down.
Xavier's comment throwing section. Shade at Everybody me as well. And he says I'm going to be section. An MK in 2029. I'll be 68 years old in 2029. I'm not going there.
Everybody that's in the comments better make sure that they like and subscribe. Tell your friends about us. This was a fantastic conversation. Yeah, thank you for coming
thank
on,
you.
Timothy.
Thank you, guys. This was wonderful. This was good.
And Mo Rabbit gets the last word. Harambe and Peanut are watching over us. All right, everybody. We will see you next Thursday for the Burning Platform. Heading towards the end of the year. And we just keep on winning.
I told you guys, by the time we get to the end of this year, we all, by the seat of our pants.
I just want to point out, Tulsi Gabbard is now the Director of National Intelligence, right? So she's your cousin's boss now.
Yeah.
And just a couple of weeks ago, she was on the terror watch list.
Yeah.
Now she controls the terror watch list. That is the biggest fuck you ever.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think she's going to walk in there and change a lot of things. It's going to be terrific. Yep. Good stuff. Let's just all stay alive, please. That's very important, too. Thank you.
Cheers, man.